Dr. F.A.C. Ola's Real Tree.
There were certain events which took place which frightened us. For example, there was a time when a whole group of them came to the house and knocked at the door furiously, and they came to confiscate the cars. I didn't have a car, but my father-in-law had one, had two, I think, and they took away his car. But because he explained that he was a doctor, he had to have a car, they left him a small one. And here's an example of this friendliness of the Japanese officer in our neighborhood. When he heard about this, he said, oh, he's terribly sorry. And he came the following day or day after with a new car for my father-in-law and a car for me. I didn't lose the car, but he says, you can have it. I don't know whose car it was. So he says, I can have it. I said, thank you very much. So I was given this car, which I was able to use. Of course, the big question is how to get petrol. And so the car really was not very much in use because there's no petrol, or very little petrol to be got. My father-in-law, being a doctor, had his ration of petrol, so much petrol per month, but I didn't. Confiscation of bicycles and so on. And we were actually earlier on than that. We were clutching at all kinds of ways to protect ourselves against any acts of violence by the Japanese. There was a, you know, these Japanese had interpreters, and there was a Malay. I remember this Malay guy who came along with the Japanese in the neighborhood, and came along, and he spoke Japanese, and he spoke to us, and we thought that we could help him. And of course, for a few dollars, quite a few dollars, that was then a lot of money, we gave him some money, and he was on the take, you see. So he wrote something out in what we thought was Japanese to stick on our door, to tell these people to stay away. But subsequently we realized that we were made fools of, because all this was nonsense. There was nothing, it was just a whole lot, it meant nothing, it was just squiggles that looked like Japanese, had no meaning whatsoever, so he took us for a ride. This boy was a crook. Things like that. Now, as the days wore on, we realized that things were not as bad as we had thought that they might be. They weren't going around killing people, decapitating people, and so on. Of course, the dreadful part was when they asked the Chinese to report at certain centers to be given identity cards, ostensibly. I know one of my very best friends in college was a boy called Ong Wee Lee. Now, Ong Wee Lee had two brothers, just three sons in a family, wealthy family. They stayed where the just next in Scots Road, just next to Goodwood Hotel, where the old York Hotel was. That was the house, and they went to report. Ong Wee Lee had just got married. He was a very good friend of mine. None of the three boys ever returned, and so we had so many incidents like this. And this is, to me, closest to home, because I was so friendly with Wee Lee.
Did you know why they were being taken away?
Why, I don't know, but we didn't know, but of course these were just reprisals, the Japanese reprisals against Chinese for what they did to them, I suppose, in the war in China. They were arch enemies, Japanese and Chinese.
Was your friend involved in any kind of...
Not in the least. He was not involved in any activity whatsoever. He was a darn nice dental student, minding his own business, and his brothers, elder brother and a younger brother.
Um, How did this incident of the Japanese rounding up the Chinese have an impact on your own feelings, your reactions to this whole thing?
Oh, we got angry, you know. I mean, this was unforgivable that they could do a thing like this. I mean, to us they were without feeling. Cannibals, you know, they were honestly despicable individuals who could do things like this. This is how we felt. This was early on, of course, and this all added to our fears. And we were wondering what lay in store. What next? What next? Then, of course, there were those of us who were screened for being first generation Europeans. My father, my mother, and they were given red badges. They were not sent into Changi. They were given red badges to wear. Brother-in-law and so on. But not me, I was second generation, nor my wife.
Did you know where did they go for their screening?
School fields mainly, Padang, various places.
When was that?
Soon after the Japanese came, and just a few weeks later. And then we heard of them being taken away to such places like Changi, the hills near Bedok, and being shot. They made to wade into the water in Changi and shot as they waded. Some had to dig their own trenches and were shot.
The Chinese.
Such dreadful acts were perpetrated, acts of violence. And all of them were innocent citizens, not involved, as we could see it, in anything anti-Japanese.
For the Eurasian community, only those who were first generation were given the red tags.
That's right.
Did you remember how was the red tag like?
Oh, it is a... I can remember just a red circle, I think, or a red square, and with some character, which I couldn't understand, marked on it. And they had to wear it everywhere they went.
Does it mean... did it have any... Did it affect the rations or...
Rations? I don't think so. I think they were given as much rations as we were. They were allowed out. But I think they had to report every now and again. I really cannot remember what their requirements were, what they had to do. But as the days wore on, right, we found that it was safe enough for us to go out, shop. I used to go to a little shop and by the Jembatan Merah in Thompson Road to buy our daily requirements. And then an outing would be to Sungai Road, Thieves Market, and the manner of things that you could pick up there. Do you know, cut glass, expensive things, all looted, all going so cheaply. If you were an antique collector, Ming vases and all kinds of things, because we weren't then. All readily available, so cheap there, Sungai Road. And I thought that in order to that I could produce some kind of income, I would try and turn out some tooth powder. Being a dental student, I knew the form, the rough formula of what the tooth powder should be. So I experimented and I came up with a tooth powder called Kulene, K-U-L-E-N-E, and the slogan was "Keep your teeth, your mouth cool and clean." So the name was Kulene, K-U-L-E-N-E. There was now how to market it, how to make it attractive. I had little tubes made, tin tubes made, and a label which was designed by my father-in-law's wife. She's a good artist. And I did all the stirring myself, the mixing myself, and filling in myself, labeling myself, packing myself, now to sell. Of course, nobody would buy, because the Japanese by that time were bringing in lap tooth powder, Tiger brand or some brand, I can't remember, or Lion brand. And but my tooth powder had a nice taste. That's what, if anything at all, had a nice taste. And I managed to get a few stores I knew. I went by Snelly and I said, "Look, would you try and sell it all on consignment?" Nobody would buy. They said, "You, they'll put it on consignment," and they would. I would go around every week or every fortnight and replenish their consignment if they had sold it and get my money, and so on. And there was one famous store at that time in Singapore called Aurora, at the junction of High Street and North Bridge Road. They wouldn't stock my tooth powder. But this is, there was one of the most famous stores, and people were going there to buy things, you know. So what I did was I got all my friends to go there. Like Carl Schubert, whose mother was injured by the shell in Lincoln Road, and a few others, to go to Aurora and ask for the Kulene tooth powder. Ask for it. And I said, "Sorry, you haven't got it." He says, "Why?" "Because it's very nice. You should buy it." So, of course, after a few of my friends had gone, they started stocking. So there's little tricks like that. And so I was able to earn something out of that, but not enough. And meanwhile, I was learning Japanese. Everybody there then was learning Japanese. I mean, you had to learn Japanese. So I got lessons in Japanese, and I was able to speak a little bit. Enough for me to get myself a job as a telephone operator at Raffles Hotel. Now, Raffles Hotel was a place where the Japanese officers were billeted. And how I got it, I really don't know. Maybe it's because of my father-in-law was working with the Gunsebo, which is a civilian, he was a medical officer in the civilian setup. And I think one of the officers there, he said, "Look, my son-in-law is looking for a job, can you help him?" So I think that's how I got this job. So it's a question of moshi moshi, and then, you know. And I didn't stay very long. I didn't like the job, and I was scolded all the time. You know, as telephone operators, are always scolded. And these Japanese get a scolding from the Japanese, no fun. So I didn't stay long on that one. And I then got a job as a dental assistant, which served me much better, at the SRC. There was a young Japanese dental officer there called Sato. Bit of an eccentric, and that was when I had my first experience of clinical dentistry. I'd never done any clinical dentistry apart from denture work in the school before the war. Dentures, yes, but any actual clinical work like filling teeth, extracting teeth, and so on, no. But this is my first experience there. It was not only a dental clinic, there was also a medical center there for outpatients, treating Japanese civilians, and I think some military personnel too.
Dr. Ulis, what did you do on the first few days after the fall of Singapore?
Well, when we finally reached the house, we course, we on the way back, we were, it was scary because there were these Japanese around. But we were a bit reassured because there were other Singaporeans, other people moving around as well. And we got back. There were my wife and myself and my sister-in-law and mother-in-law. And we came with two friends, Gordon Scott and Alice Tay. Not Alice, Gurley Tay. We found our house. We found that it had been shelled, but not nearly as bad as my father-in-law's house, which is next door. It was a semi-detached house. And we were very fearful of the fact that the Japanese soldiers around us might try to molest the women folk. And we stayed indoors for most of the time. Now, in fact, for the first week or two, we didn't venture out anywhere. We just remain indoors, just scared, too scared to do anything, but we could observe that in the neighborhood there were these Japanese soldiers, billeted, and they used to walk around in groups, bathe in the standpipe along Lincoln Road, naked. They left us, generally left us alone, except for one man who did try to get friendly, knock at the doors, and he was a shifty sort of a character, and we could sense that he was after a woman, but we were able to ward him off. He did, however, as was narrated in my father-in-law's book, try to go after their armor, but she fled. They called him Slippery Sam, this man. Now, it seemed pretty obvious to us then that we had to do something about our livelihood. We did have a supply of canned food. We had a little rice, a little stored up, some sugar and some milk and the necessities, but these could never have lasted forever. So I got down to planting vegetables. I got down to setting up a poultry run and got a few poultry. You see, even at those early days, there were hawkers coming around selling things, and there were those who came along selling live poultry, and I was able to buy a few, and with the hope of rearing them, with the hope of getting eggs from them. Whilst we were a bit apprehensive of the Japanese, we thought it would be a wise thing to do to try and seek out the decent ones among them, because there were many decent ones among them, as we later found out, and sort of befriend them so that they could protect us from the bad elements, if there were bad elements there. Because you see, we exaggerated, we had all kinds of ideas, exaggerated ideas, that every one of them was a bad hat. It wasn't true. I mean, they were human beings. and there were some good chaps among them, and there were some bad chaps among them. And funnily enough, the bad chaps we later found out were Koreans, not the Japanese. So we got to know a few of these Japanese soldiers. They used to come along to the house, bring pictures of their families, show their pictures of their wives and their children, and they started teaching us Japanese. Good chaps. One chap I remember was who came from Kyushu. He drew the island. Can't remember his name. And so this was a nucleus of a kind of a camaraderie, a friendship that we developed among these Japanese people. But the one who really did a lot for us was a captain. Again, I couldn't think of his name. I cannot think of his name. And he did help us quite considerably. He took pity on us. For example, there was a time when a group of Japanese soldiers came with a lot of noise, you know, shouts and things, and they came to relieve us, or those of us, I didn't have one, my father-in-law did have, our cars. So they took all the cars away, they took the bicycles away. This Japanese officer, you know, he felt that we had been deprived of this, and he came along with his men one day and with kerosene tins full of rice, of sugar, some milk, and a few provisions. You know, he did things like that. He even brought me a car. I didn't have a car to be taken away, but he even brought me a car. Where he got it from, I don't know. And of course the car was no use to me because I couldn't get petrol. My father-in-law was a doctor. I think he made some use of the car, but the rest of the time it was all waste of, you know, couldn't use it. Gradually, you know, we found that we were able to move about more freely, and that it wasn't likely that any harm would come to us. The Japanese in the neighborhood of Lincoln Road were those, some of them had come with the troops in the front line and were billeted there to rest, and then there were the relief ones also who were there, and it was, I think, R&R, rest and recreation, because in the house immediately behind ours, a very large house, a two-story house, rambling old colonial house, had been converted into a comfort house for the Japanese, and they were filled with Korean girls, and that was their recreation, the Japanese soldiers. And these Korean girls were nice girls. I mean, they used to poke their head out of the windows and have chats with us, my wife and myself. Now, not that we could understand them, but they could try and speak a little English to us. Now, we started venturing out when we found that things were getting a little easier, and we felt that being Eurasians, we were not being hounded as much as were the Chinese. Because you remember that many of these Chinese, or all of them in fact, were required to congregate in certain areas, or registration ostensibly, but so many of them were removed and never heard of afterwards.
Dr. Lewis, when you were in the house, how did you get this news of what was happening outside your area? For instance, about the Chinese having to register themselves.
Well, our neighbors were Chinese. Many neighbors of ours were Chinese. And they themselves had to go. And they told us what happened when they came back. In that family, nobody was lost. So we got information by word of mouth.
Did you know what the Japanese, those Japanese that were in Lincoln Road, which group did they belong to?
Oh, I don't know what unit they came from, but they were soldiers, infantry people.
How long did they stay in Lincoln Road?
Not in Lincoln Road itself. They were deleted in Newton Road, which is just behind Lincoln Road. Lots of houses there. They were there for a good few months, and then they moved on. When the civil government came in, now,
doctors, could you describe for us the conditions in Singapore during the early days of the Japanese occupation?
Of course, the conditions were those of complete uncertainty, trepidation, we didn't know what was happening, but we were always hopeful of the fact that it wouldn't be long before the Allies would land and save us. We were always hoping, we always had that hope that they were coming, and there was sort of the odd rumor that, you know, that was what was in, that was pending any moment. But of course that didn't turn out. Now, of course, we heard of cases of looting, and we'd heard of how the Japanese treated the looters mercilessly. We woke up one morning to hear that we should all go to the front of the Cathay cinema to view the heads of a few looters who they had been beheaded, and the heads were on display. It was the Japanese a way of telling the people of Singapore that they stand no nonsense. That they would, that's their way of punishment.
Who asked you to go and have a look?
The neighbors next door. You see?